Good morning, and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. My name is Barbara Park, and my pronouns are she, her, hers. I've been a member of Prairie for 40 years. I think I've served on probably every spot there is over the course of time. I'm currently on the Ministerial Search Committee and on the Archives Committee. And when such things happen, I'm the choir director. That may be a while yet, though. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation. We strive to be welcoming to all, though we recognize that we all have biases that limit our understanding of how others may perceive us. We stumble in our efforts, but we commit to keep trying to grow our ability to love people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, family structure, age, ability, or inabilities. During our virtual coffee hour at the end of the service, we invite visitors, guests, and returning friends to introduce yourselves so that we might get to know you better. We will also have joys and concerns during that time and then break into small groups for more discussion and general chatting. We have a few announcements this morning. See the order of service email to Prairie News for more information and links. We're sharing our offering this quarter with the Allied Wellness Center. The Wellness Center is a neighborhood center with the purpose of promoting health and wellness of mind, body, and spirit of people living in the Allied, Belmar, and Dunsmarsh neighborhoods. Reminder that the fall Prairie UU retreat is happening now. See the details of it on Prairie News for the schedule and the Zoom links. Prairie sing-along is tonight and every Sunday night at 6 p.m. Note the new time moving forward. It used to be 7. Virtual Dungeons and Dragons, the beginners group, is every Monday at 4:30. And the advanced group is every Friday at 4:30. Wednesday fun night this week is at 6 p.m. and we'll see animals, virtually that is, from the Heartland Farm Sanctuary. So that should be a lot of fun. Carol Carter Walker will read our chalice lighting, Prayer for Living Tension by Reverend Joseph Cherry.
If we have any hope of transforming the world and saving ourselves, we must be bold enough to step into our discomfort, brave enough to be clumsy there, loving enough to forgive ourselves and others. May we, as a people of faith, be granted the strength to be so bold, so brave, and so loving.
I'll have to apologize. I was going to light a chalice, and I put out the light candle by mistake when I went to do it. Okay, now we're going to have a story for all ages. We Don't Eat Our Classmates by Ryan T. Higgins.
We don't eat our classmates. By the New York Times best-selling author, Ryan T. Higgins. Hey kids, you will never be eaten by a T-Rex. They are extinct, I promise. Penelope Rex was nervous. It's not every day a little T-Rex starts school. What are my classmates going to be like? Will they be nice? How many teeth will they have? This was very important. Penelope's mom bought her a new backpack with ponies on it. Ponies were Penelope's favorite. because ponies are delicious. Penelope's dad packed her a lunch of 300 tuna sandwiches and one apple juice. Finally, the big day came, and Penelope Rex was very surprised to find out that all of her classmates were children. So she ate them because children are delicious. Penelope Rex, said Mrs. Noodleman, we don't eat our classmates. Please spit them out at once. So she did. It was not the best way to start school. Still, Penelope was determined to have a good first day. She tried hard to make friends at recess. She finger-painted some of her best work. She even saved Griffin Emery a seat at lunch. You can sit here. Penelope started to notice everyone was making friends but her. It was lonely. When she got home, her dad asked about her first day of school. I didn't make any friends, Penelope cried. None of the children wanted to play with me. Penelope Rex, her father asked, did you eat your classmates? Well, maybe, sort of, just a little bit. Sometimes it's hard to make friends, said her dad, especially if you eat them. You see, Penelope, children are the same as us, on the inside, just tastier. That gave Penelope a lot to think about. The next day, Penelope tried really hard. But poor Penelope, she could not stop herself from eating her classmates. Mrs. Noodleman, Penelope ate William Amoto again! And they were all afraid of her. Except Walter. Walter was a goldfish. So Penelope tried to make friends with him. Will you be my friend? Chomp! Eee! Cried Penelope. He's eating my finger! Wah! Once Penelope found out what it was like to be someone's snack, she lost her appetite for children. She stopped eating her classmates. Even when Cece Woodman spilled barbecue sauce all over herself. And soon, Penelope made friends. Found you! Want a brownie? I helped make them. Now, even when children look especially delicious, she peeks at Walter and remembers what it's like when someone tries to eat you. And Walter, the goldfish, stares right back at her and licks his lips. Because dinosaurs are delicious.
Well, I finally got the chalice lit. I hope you had better luck on yours than I did on mine. Now we're going to have a minute of silent meditation. Well, today's presentation is Why I Do This Work by Carol Carter Walker and Amanda Schuber. And it relates to our first principle, the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Carol Carter Walker has been a UU for 33 years, beginning as a charter member of the Sojourner Truth UU Congregation of Washington, D.C. in 1987. founded with the explicit goal of attracting more African Americans to Unitarian Universalism. Since 2002, she's been an active member of the Paint Branch UU Church, located in a suburb of Washington, D.C. Carol has been a Beyond Categorical Thinking facilitator since 2008. She also serves as co-chair of the Central East Region's Chalice Lighter Growth Committee. She is a member of the UU-affiliated Diverse and Revolutionary UU Multicultural Ministries, otherwise known as DRUM, and Black Lives of UU. She's currently on her congregation's Board of Trustees and is immediate past chair of its Diversity Anti-Racism Transformation Team. Amanda Schuber has been a UU for 27 years, serving in different capacities of her church in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, as a former director of religious education and social action coordinator, and for 2 years at the UUA headquarters in Boston as administrator of the Office of Congregational Fundraising. She's also served as a board member of numerous UU organizations. She and her family are currently members of the Unitarian Universalist Church in Huntsville, Alabama, and is a third year of the Masters of Divinity program at Star King School for the Ministry. She focused on oppression studies while studying at the University of Alabama, and she's an advocate for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender rights, along with spending many years leading workshops on accessibility and diversity. In her spare time, which I don't think she has much of, she travels the country working with UU congregations as a Beyond Categorical Thinking facilitator, assisting congregations in examining bias in the ministerial search process. Many of us have had a chance to meet them in the two workshops that we've already had, and we're very pleased to welcome them this morning.
Thank you. My name is Carol Carter Walker. My pronouns are she, her, and hers. It is really good to be with you this morning, and as good to be with some of you Thursday and Saturday. Now, we UUs are generally a polite bunch. Your ministerial search committee, particularly Renee, have promoted this Beyond Categorical Thinking weekend. Several people have worked on this morning's service, and I begin by thanking you all for your work. Everyone I have met virtually has been warm and gracious, but I'm sure many of you are wondering, who are they? Why are they here? Haven't we had enough meetings, surveys, workshops, small group discussions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, about our ministerial search? Having had several contract ministers, don't they think we know what to do? Well, it might be best to tell you what we're not here to do. We're not from the Unitarian Universalist headquarters in Boston down here to tell you whom to select for your minister. We are volunteers, not paid UU staff, part of a diverse cadre of UUs who are both lay and clergy, who are trained to do this work. We are not here to represent the interest of the UUA, the Mid-America region, or even your search committee, because it is you using the resources of your search committee whom you've entrusted to bring you the best fit for your ministry as a candidate, and your personal commitment and gifts of your time, talent, and treasure that have led you through the often difficult work necessary to prepare for a new life in the chapter of this society that will result in the call of your next minister. We recognize that your quest for a new ministry has been particularly challenging in this time of the pandemic and the changes it has mandated in your personal and fellowship lives. I admire your resiliency. What Amanda and I are here to do in both the two parts of the Beyond Categorical Thinking workshop, which took place last Thursday and Saturday, and today, is to facilitate the deepening and widening of the process of determining the person or persons who will best fit your church's needs. The person who will not come necessarily in the gender, color, sexual preference, ability package you initially envisioned. Now, you may be thinking to yourself, why shouldn't I be able to express my heart and head felt preferences? Why can't I be honest about feeling uncomfortable with people who fall into certain racial, ethnic, gender, sexual preference, and ability categories? Well, the truth is you can. But I hope you will acknowledge this discomfort, own it, and then explore another way, another path. As a UU for more than 33 years, I think our shared faith could reach the beloved community of which so many speak, where who a person is not defined by categories, but by most profound and more mundane aspects of themselves. The UUA, our denomination, has made many attempts to address and eradicate the barriers that have made this pretty much a white denomination. I've seen data that ranges from 75% to 89% of white. I've worked on all these initiatives for most of my time at as a UU. I've been at the heights of hope and depths of disgust. The high point still for me was 2012, when 3,000 UUs, most of them my age, went to the desert to protest the illegal and inhumane actions of Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Our current UUA president, Reverend Susan Frederick Ray, was a leader of the UUs in that Phoenix movement. We stood vigil outside that camp in 100 plus degree weather for several hours and showed people that we were there for them and with them. Another high point was seeing UU ministers locking arms with other clergy to protest the KKK neo-Nazi protesters in Charlottesville. Still another, the number of congregations displaying Black Lives Matter banners, often alongside rainbow flags on their church property. The one at my church was vandalized several months after it was raised, and before the morning was out, folks at service spontaneously donated money to replace it and buy an extra one just in case. On the other hand, I was disgusted when the hiring practices at the UUA that devalued persons of color, particularly women, were exposed. I was enraged when obscene severance packages totaling $500,000 for two top former UUA leaders became known. I nearly walked out of General Assembly 2 years ago when delegates voted to study the corruption of democracy instead of Black Lives Matter. I saw this as another sidestep on the part of we UUs. What then keeps me here? First, I am stubborn. I like to overcome a challenge. More seriously, I am a UU and I have a seat at the welcome table and not below the salt. Finally, if we can live into instead of just speak our principles, we can be a beloved community that can share our saving message with all. What keeps me here is the opportunity to know myself and know the other and to break down the barriers that separate us. So I stay, working on many things at many levels. I've served on the boards of two congregations. I've been a worship associate of my church. I've served on my former district's board, chaired its finance and administration and bylaws for committees, and am currently on its Challenge Leaders Committee. I've also served on committees at the denominational level. But most of my work and much of my passion in recent years has focused on creating the beloved community within my church. I am dedicated to working to ensure that we fully respect the inherent worth and dignity of all, and our congregations look like most of the world outside of our doors, from both sides of the pulpit. As the end of the year approaches, it is usually both a tumultuous and reflective time of year for me. Like a knitter, I look back to pick up the threads of unkept commitments and resolutions and stitch them together with new interests and passions into a refreshed pattern for my life going forward into the new year. I review my list of to-dos and charities to support during the upcoming year. I review my commitments to this movement, particularly the work related to our first principle. This year, for the first time, I've been rethinking my commitment to my particular church. I was frustrated by the lack of progress in our quest for beloved community. We are in a majority-minority community just outside of Washington, D.C., yet our congregation does not reflect these demographics. We are about 12% people of color, high for most UU congregations, but still falling well below the demographics of our neighborhood. But then in talking with other UUs, particularly those of color in caucuses and conferences, I realized the UU churches are the same differently. Most congregations are grappling with the issues of beloved community, whether they are virtually all white or not. Over 700 congregations heeded the call to hold a white supremacy teach-in last spring. The teach-ins, particularly the terminology used, has stirred things up. But I'm hoping that we are big enough to get beyond concerns about words. You know, we use the creatures of the word. No matter how jarring and triggering they might be, and dig for the message undergirding those words. In Phoenix in 2012, I saw UUs being humble. Now, you know, we UUs are many things, but humble is not a word that comes to mind in describing us. For the first time, and since then several times, I saw UUs working across faith lines, respecting those with different beliefs. I saw UUs decentering ourselves and working with immigrant communities and organizations, not as leaders, but as partners. We came to listen and take in, to ask, how can we be of service, and wait for the answer, not merely take notes, but to work in collaboration and partnership rather than in a kind of post-colonial, we'll help you by identifying your problem and providing or directing you to the solution kind of way. Amanda and I hope that the Beyond Categorical Thinking workshop that we facilitated this past week will provide a common container for all in this society to have more deep talk around issues of race, gender, abilities, affection that might impact who you might consider for your next ministry. These exercises might also make members more open to examining these issues as they relate to the broader society life. We were limited in time to do as deep a dive as we wanted to do because of the conversion from in-person to virtual sessions. However, we will be leaving a packet of materials with the search committee that the congregation may want to explore more deeply. For me, whatever has been stirred by the white supremacy teachings and the workshops must be accompanied by a big dose of cultural humility. For me, this means two things: understanding that culture is complex and ever-changing, and committing to a lifelong process of self-reflection and self-critique about my biases, faulty assumptions, and misperception. In short, mostly an internal examination of oneself rather than the other. Being culturally humble is hard work. It's so easy to default to the stereotypes, misconceptions, and false assumptions about other people. It's hard going to learn a new language or new way of being and to constantly assess one's own behavior to excise cultural superiority. I am convinced that this is the strongest tool we have to use in this work. So as the new year approaches, I have reaffirmed my decision of 33 years to take my seat at the welcome table. This is my passion, my calling as a UU. The work that this society has done during the workshop and the work that I hope you will continue to do is simply a way for us all to expand our thinking about who might sit at your table as a minister, and helps you prepare to welcome all to our doors. In the words of Reverend Peter Morales, former president of our denomination, quote, "Someone, a long-lost relative of the human family, is coming into our lives. At church, it happens every single Sunday. May you and I be there with anticipation in our hearts, warm smiles on our face, and eyes ready to truly meeting the eyes of the other, and with our arms extended, saying, welcome, welcome.
May it be so. It is a joy to be with you this morning. My name is Amanda Schuber. My pronouns are she, her, or anything said in love. I am a divinity student, a mother, a passionate activist, and a storyteller. Today, I'd like to share with you just a bit of my story, a bit of the reason that I do the work I do, a bit of why this work is so important. I have two mommies, she exclaimed in the resounding voice that only a toddler can muster, that kind of voice that demands your attention and seems to have a permanently broken volume control. There, standing in the grocery checkout line early on a Saturday morning, my then 2-year-old daughter, Nora, had once again decided that the friendly cashier, who had innocently asked how old she was, really needed to know if she had a mommy or a daddy. This scene had played out several times over the preceding weeks at the bank line, the shoe store, the doctor's office. In fact, anyone who dared to venture within 30 feet of her was privy to the news that Nora had two mommies. And as every time before, this scene proceeded very much like a scripted play. The cashier looked at me, her face confused, questions written all over her. What did you say, honey? And like every time before, I jumped in. Oh, you know, toddlers, who knows what she says? I can barely understand her most of the time. Wow, what a beautiful ring you're wearing. Only this time was different. This time, my precious daughter sat in the cart at eye level. This time, I couldn't help but catch the gaze, the one that showed confusion and shame as it took root there in her heart. This time, the anguish I felt the anguish of a parent realizing that I had just taught my daughter a lesson that I instantly wished I could take back. In that moment of rapid diversion, that verbal sleight of hand, the redirection of a potentially uncomfortable confrontation, I had taught my daughter to be ashamed of our family. I had taught her fear and the beginning steps of a dance that I swore to protect her from. I had made a quick decision to neatly pack up that moment in a box, to tie it with a pretty ribbon, one that made my existence as both a parent and a lesbian easier for the world to digest, or better yet, just ignore. From the earliest of ages, we are taught to put things into categories. Any Sesame Street fan, or parent or grandparent of a Sesame Street fan, may know the famous song, "One of these things is not like the other. One of these things just does not belong." As early as 1 year of age, children are able to distinguish difference. And it's those categories that provide our lives with order, structure, understanding, and even comfort. They let us know where things belong, where people belong, where we belong. I, as I imagine most of you have done, have spent a great deal of time thinking about where I belong in this world. And we have spent this time with you over this past week to help you think about who belongs here or there with you in community, in that pulpit. We have helped you unpack your boxes to see what is held and what may be hiding inside of them. Now, I grew up in Alabama, the first grandchild of a very large, very proper Southern family. I was brought up to be attentive to all the best Southern graces, and I can still set a formal table with my eyes closed. I attended college, was active in my community, and I performed in voice, theater, and concert symphony. I was the apple of my family's eye, and I sat on a pedestal that was not only high, but very precariously grounded in my ability to do no wrong and, for gosh sake, never, ever embarrass the family. Needless to say, that fall from that very high pedestal was a long but quick descent. I was 22 years old when I came out as a lesbian and gay rights activist on CNN. Yeah, you heard me. CNN, your source for up-to-the-minute news. Now, I will be the first to admit that the decision to give an interview to a local TV station at the annual Gay Pride Festival in Birmingham, not one of my best decisions. But I really had no way of knowing that CNN would pick up the feed or that an aunt some three times removed would happen to be watching and promptly pick up the phone and call my very conservative grandmother. The fallout was devastating. My mother had known about my life for a very long time and really was only concerned with my safety, happiness, and well-being. I wish I could say that was true for the rest of my family. For nearly 12 years, they felt betrayed, ashamed, and horribly embarrassed. Now, I am happy to say that after some time and great-grandchildren, things have greatly improved, and my family now accepts and loves my wife and our children with open arms, at least in private. Now, I had only unpacked my identity in a very, very limited way for my family. I had allowed them to see only the pieces of me that I thought they could handle, the ones that would prevent confrontation. It could be argued that if they had dug a little deeper and looked a little harder, or if I had felt just a little bit safer, the other sides of my life would have shown through. They would have found a piece of me, another aspect that makes me uniquely who I am. But once they were allowed to see the parts of my life that identify me as a lesbian, all other accomplishments were lost. They were behind what they saw as my glaring differences from them. Gone were all of my accomplishments in theater. Gone were the hundreds and hundreds of volunteer hours that earned me scholarship to college. Gone was my identity as the beloved grandchild. Instead, they were replaced with an otherness and an inability to see me as a whole person. Emerson once wrote, "People only see what they are prepared to see." And I can tell you, my friends, that we are very seldom prepared to challenge what we think we know. Early in the year 2000, I came out to an old high school buddy. And for the next year, she would introduce me as, "This is my lesbian friend, Amanda." And I could never decide if that pronouncement was a badge of honor or a tidy warning label. But I believe fair is fair. So I started to introduce her by saying, "This is my Republican friend, Sarah." She was clearly confused. And after a few minutes, she started to understand the problem. So I'm sure that you see my point here. Even though she had known me for years prior to my coming out, by labeling me, she created a social shorthand, boxing me up neatly to give social cues to the rest of the world. She had also unintentionally stripped me of all of my other identities. I'm confident that there's not one person in this room today that is one-dimensional. We have all spent our lives trying on new identities, casting off those that we outgrow, and evolving into who we are today in this moment, in this space. We all have learned how to package up our identities, and when it is necessary, and far too often only when it is safe, to unpack those identities for the rest of the world. Now, I've shared just a small portion of my story with you this morning, a snapshot of a lifetime. My identity has shaped me. It's hindered me at times, and it has compelled me to become a beyond categorical thinking trainer. My experiences with identity consistently reaffirm my belief that it is essential to hear each other's stories and to understand each other's truth, to meet people where they are, lest we fall into the trap of boxing people up for our own comfort. As I buckled her into her car seat that early Saturday morning, Nora spoke for the first time since I had hurriedly redirected the cashier's attention. "I have two mommies." She said it in a near whisper. And as I looked in those blue eyes that matched my own, I could not help but fear the tears welling up. I shook my head in affirmation because I was terrified my voice would betray me. I laid my forehead to hers, our shared gesture of affection since her birth. "My mommies love me very much," she said. And she said it with the assured confidence of one who cannot be swayed. "Yes," I said, "very much." And there it was, from the heart of a child, demanding to be acknowledged for her story, for her identity, separate from my own. I was reminded again that this work never, ever ends. The boxes that we pull behind us, the boxes that we struggle to break out of, even the boxes where we seek refuge, must never, ever be allowed to be the sole measure of our identity. There is not a box big enough to contain our messy lives and our ever-changing identities. We have this last week asked you to look inside your boxes, to dig deep into the dark and scary places, to stretch, possibly bust a few seams here and there. We've asked you to share your stories, and we asked you to witness the transformative power of really knowing someone beyond labels, beyond categories, and most certainly beyond boxes. Amen. Shalom. Blessed be and Ashe.
Thank you so much, both to Amanda and Carol. Now we'll have a open up for a short time of discussion. Please raise your hand virtually in the participation box or via your camera, and we'll call on you and unmute you, though you may need to unmute yourself. That's a hard act to follow, Amanda.
Wow, we've left him speechless, Carol.
Mary's got her hand raised.
Well, as I was listening to Amanda talk, I was reminded of when I was a teenager and I had done something that my parents didn't want, and it didn't seem to matter. It seemed very important to them that I really fit in completely and that nothing I did to make up for it, you know, I had a lot of accomplishments and so on. You know, they just wanted that one thing to be corrected. And I thought, well, that's not really fair that they weren't seeing me as valuable as I thought I was just because I had done one thing wrong in their eyes. So that touched me.
Unfortunately, it is all too easy in our society to focus in on the one thing that we feel we want to correct, or the one thing that is different from us, and let that be the measure of the person. And unfortunately, that means we miss all the glorious and wonderful other aspects that make us human. We as humans have the unique ability to be more than one thing at a time. Not any other creature really has that.
And I just want to add also that as Carol was speaking, Carol, I kept thinking of our former member, now dead for maybe 10 years, Pat Watkins. And she was our our main Black member, I guess, at that time. And she was always trying to get us to do the UU curriculum. I can't remember the title of it, but it was to help congregations become more aware of their biases in regard to Black people and not having members in their congregation. We never did that curriculum. And, you know, she just couldn't get our congregation to do that. And then some other things that she shared with me was that when she was on the board, and she was often on the board, she was the person who named our newsletter, the Prairie Fire. I mean, she was a very active member and gave services as we were totally lay-led congregation then. She said that as she sat on the board, she would make suggestions for something to be done, and she would be ignored. But then if another person made that same suggestion, they would their idea would be accepted right away and talked about. And, you know, it was she understood that to be because she was Black, and that was the reason that they were that our board and our congregation would not go ahead with some of the suggestions, many of the suggestions that she made. So I really felt for her in that respect.
I appreciate your comment, Mary. And I think that that's, you know, unfortunately, that happens a lot in congregations. As a matter of fact, I think the most damaging thing in congregations is silence. Those of you who were here yesterday, you know, when we did the exercise, we got into a little bit of the case studies and what would people say. I think it's hard, especially if you feel like you don't have allies in the congregation to call that out. But I think calling it out is sort of the first step in combating it, for want of a better word.
Arlene's got her hand up.
I think Pat was also responsible, though, for the series that we did do on white privilege, as well as some other services that I felt were landmark services. She did one about her family history, which was very insightful in terms of the influences that her grandparents and her parents had had on her life, and how they had been in their own era very advocates for rights of, at that time it would have been colored people. And then she had worked on the jury, she had headed up the jury study for the local League of Women Voters, and which was exciting because we found reference to it when we wrote up our history and for our 100-year anniversary. And she presented that to us, as well as, I mean, I remember numerous times that she did, she was a staunch advocate of the United Nations, made sure that we always had United Nations service every year, and just was a genuinely warm person in so many ways. And I thought she was very influential in our congregation.
But there's no denying what she told me and how she right. felt that often there, you know, at the board, her suggestions, which then later became other people's suggestions when they came from her, were ignored, met with silence. And so I'll stand by that.
Far too often we as congregants, or I'll say it, as white people who identify as white, which the vast majority of this room is, oftentimes we will wait and ask our people of color within our congregation to lead us through the education and the work that needs to be done. And I can tell you from speaking at length with members of the movements that I'm a part of, that is an exhausting burden to bear. Asking and waiting for them to lead us were to teach us. And so so it is a hard thing to do, and especially when we have the resources at our hands.
Are you, as a presenter, calling on people? I see Nancy's hand. I didn't want to.
Yeah, Barb, there's two virtual hands. Steve has his hand up pretty early, and Kathy had their hand up too. So I don't know if you want to call on one.
Right, yeah. And Nancy has a hand up, her physical hand up.
Why don't you go ahead, Renee? You can see those.
All right, Steve, can you unmute yourself and you can.
Yeah, Amanda really was moved by your sermon. I appreciate it, and I know some in our congregation don't like the idea of preaching or sermons, but I'm one who does and miss it, have missed it since we lost our minister, and so I guess that's part of why I'm on the ministerial search committee, I just look forward to having a minister again.
Kathy, you want to go ahead?
Actually, Randy?
Randy?
Randy's thought. I just wanted to follow up on the idea around categories. I think I agree with the two presenters that categories are crucial to our existence, how people communicate with each other. We need to create categories. But on the other hand, as they so adequately and eloquently said, that it creates a real problem for us because we tend to box people in with that reality. So like Amanda says, I think we're given the fact that since categories are a real important part of our world, we have to always deal with the fact that that will be part of us, a necessary part, but a part that needs to be softened and expanded at all times.
And thank you, Nancy. Do you want to unmute yourself? There you go. You got it. You're unmuted.
I was a close friend of Pat's for many years, and she did so much in terms of the workings of our congregation and in trying to lead us to a better place. And she would go to the board meetings, and she'd sit on the board meetings just to be there. And one thing that she was hurt by was she was never asked to be president of Prairie. She was never asked to be in one of those key positions. And it's very easy to not think of things that should be obvious. And she was hurt by that, and she didn't say it very often, but it's very easy to unknowingly hurt someone. And she did so much. I remember years ago when Pat and Nancy Graham and I went to James Reeve for an anti-oppression, anti-racism workshop. And it was just really clarifying how easy it is to be oppressive. And, you know, she wanted to have more things related to race brought up with the congregation. But at one point in time, she felt that the congregation felt they didn't have any problems with racism. So it was very difficult to go forward with learning more and addressing some of those concerns when people thought they were over it. But anyway, I loved her dearly and I miss her dearly.
Thank you, Nancy, for sharing that. It is clear that Pat, is that the correct name? Yeah, that Pat was a pivotal presence within your congregation and is still these many years deeply missed. So thank you, everyone who has called Pat into this space as witness. That's powerful.
Yeah.
That's probably a good place to wrap up our discussion.
Oh, Carol had something. Did you want to say something, Carol?
Yes. Yesterday afternoon, after the workshop with Prairie ended, I spoke at a memorial service for a member of our congregation, a virtual memorial service. And in hearing about, I knew something about her, I was asked by her husband to speak. And I was trying to think of something I could do to honor her that would be more substantial. And it sounds like that might be a conversation you all might want to have about this person, a workshop specifically dedicated to issues she might be interested in, a specific contribution to a fund for a nonprofit organization. I know in my case, there were a lot of ties of the person that I who died in our congregation to voting. So I'm going to give a contribution in her name to UU the Vote, for example. So just a thought that you might want to develop. And what I've gotten out of this very quick conversation is there were many sides and many dimensions to this person. She shared deeply with some members of the congregation, and some members of the congregation thought everything was A-OK. So I think that's very interesting at this point in looking at getting beyond your surface thoughts about people.
Well, Carol can just keep going because she's going to do the closing words today. All We Are One by Reverend Dr. Yvonne Shawn.
Okay, give me a minute to find it. As I said, I had a bit of a disaster this morning with Google. Google really let me down, but.
You want
Carol,
Renee to
have it up, if you would like.
Yeah, why don't you put up the order service? Save Carol from having to hunt.
Okay, so now I've got to get out of what, okay.
I have it up on.
Okay. Each of us comes from a different place, yet all we are one. We carve for ourselves our own unique space, yet all we are one. We learn how to speak, eat, dress, cook, and play in different ways. Of common homeland, we have not a trace, yet all we are one. We kill, maim, and harm one another with no thought for God's will. We forget the one God and one grace, yet all we are one. On a mountain in East Africa, near Oldolvi Gorge, our common mother Eve says that we come from one human race and all we are one.
So Amber's going to perform our closing song today, which will be Love Will Guide Us. And the words are in the order of service. So feel free to sing along.
Yeah, let me play through it once and then everybody can hear the tune and then we'll start the three verses.
Thank you, Amber.
Thank you.
Well, now is the time for our virtual coffee hour. So we'd like to start by welcoming guests and visitors. Please raise your hand.